C and Budget Stabilization Fund Advisory Board meeting to order, and the first order of business will have the roll, I believe.
Representatives Kreit?
Here.
Kempinek? Klein? Senators Klein?
Here.
Nelson?
Here.
Mr. Hardmeyer?
Here.
Mr. Rauschenberger?
Here.
Ms. Sharp? We have Sheila instead. And that's everyone.
All right. Committee, we have a quorum. We'll be probably joined by Representative Kempinek in a little bit. With that, if the minutes from the past meeting, do we need a motion to consider the minutes? There's a motion for approval of minutes. So I have a second from Senator Nelson. Any other discussion? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. Alrighty, we have the 2-11 presentation by somebody from the Retirement and Investment Office. Dave, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Push the button there, yeah.
Is that better? Very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, my name is Dave Hunter. I serve as Director and Chief Investment Officer for the North Dakota Retirement Investment Office, and have had the pleasure of doing so since December of last year. I am going to walk through the Legacy and Budget Stabilization Fund Advisory Board presentation, which you should have a copy in front of you. Absolutely. And if you have any questions, just please let me know.
Questions as we go, let's just ask them right away.
Very good. This is the agenda. The first kind of four topics are going to deal with the Budget Stabilization Fund. The next seven will deal with the Legacy Fund, and then we will wrap up with the investment policy statements that are at the end of the presentation in their entirety. On page three of your presentation, you'll see kind of a status update of the Budget Stabilization Fund at this time. Since September 2005, the new money into the program has slightly exceeded $567 million. I'd like to underscore the point that actually for the fiscal year ended 2014, it was actually $181 million of new money that came in. In the next column over, it's titled Net Increase. That actually represents investment income of slightly under $61 million since inception. To the immediate right of that, then, is distributions out of a little under $41 million. In total, as of August 31st, 2014, the market value of the Budget Stabilization Funds approximates a little under $588 million. On to the next slide. This is probably one of the simplest asset allocation schedules that I get to speak to. It is a 100% short-term fixed income and Bank of North Dakota certificates of deposit, which are rated AA+. It's a very short-term, liquid, high quality. On average, it's probably a AA, AA- overall credit quality. And its nature of the fund, being the Budget Stabilization Fund, is kind of a rainy day fund. We want to make sure that it stays liquid and short term and high quality, which it does today. On page five, we have a summary of the asset allocation between kind of the three major segments. The second line represents the Bank of North Dakota. I want to point out that there's actually a commitment on that facility of up to $200 million, so the actual size of this investment here could actually increase up to $200 million. There's an expectation based upon discussion with the president of the Bank of North Dakota that it actually could increase to up to $200 million sometime over the next 6 to 12 months, but I will defer to Mr. Hardmeyer for any further details on that. Cash and cash equivalents represent about 1% or about $7 million of the overall fund. Total short-term fixed income represents the bulk, about 80%, almost 81% of the assets. That's two very high-quality short-term fixed income investments that we split between J.P. Morgan and Babson, and they've performed very well over the past 1, 2, and 3 year periods, and we'll see that here shortly.
Dave, before we go on, maybe Eric, you want to just throw in the discussion on the banks, $200 million?
Sure. Senator Klein, members of the committee. We've had recent discussions about this lately. The Bank of North Dakota CDs represent monies put into the Bank of North Dakota that fund the Bank of North Dakota's match program. Now, I don't know if you're all familiar with that program, but it's an economic development program that we have. It funds financially strong companies, and I'll give you a few examples of companies that we have funded under this program would be, for example, American Crystal Sugar. We have done the MDU Refinery. And this is a program that has been in existence since 1989. And it has ratcheted up from a start of $25 million up to $200 million. And so the way the program works, when we have a opportunity to fund a loan under that program, since we don't have a long-term source of deposits, the deal that we struck with SIB and Rio was that they would put a CD into the bank that would match the term of the loan, and it would roughly equal the payments the borrower would make to us. So, for example, as I said, we did the a loan to MDU for part of their refinery, and this is public information, so I can tell you. And we funded it with a $30 million CD from Rio. SIB put $30 million into the bank. We turned around, relent that, those deposits. We lent those dollars to MDU to fund part of the construction of the refinery. And that's how the program works. At the Bank of North Dakota, you probably are all familiar with the fact that we get the state's deposits, right? So Ryan, who collects taxes, goes to the treasurer, they flow into the Bank of North Dakota. By law, Kelly Schmidt, the treasurer, has to deposit them there. But they're all of a nature that is short-term in nature, in terms of interest rate, 6 months to a year. So this program, the match program, allows us to fix a rate up to 5 years. And so it's called match program because we match fund it with a CD from the Budget Stabilization Fund, in essence. So that's how it works. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have about it.
Any questions? Representative Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, the loan that is made, there's always equal funding to back the loan. If it's $30 million, it's $30 million CD. It's always equal. It's never...
Mr. Kreit, or Representative Kreit, that's correct. That's the theory, is that it's actually paid back in equal annual installments, which we match with the CD. That part of it matures, gets paid back. And by the way, you should know that you take no credit risk.
Yeah.
The Budget Stabilization Fund takes no credit risk. That risk is all borne by the Bank of North Dakota. All you know, Rio, the Budget Stabilization has, is the CD, which, as Mr. Hunter has said, is we have a counterparty rating of, well, no, it's backed by the full faith and credit of the state of North Dakota. So AA plus, AAA minus, somewhere in there. So that's how we funded it. And we've been doing that, as I said, since 1989, and we roughly have $100 million outstanding in loans. So,
okay. Senator Nelson, the wheels were turning.
They were, but he was in my mind.
Okay.
All right, Dave, want to continue?
Very good, Mr. Chairman. On to the next page. Page 6 shows the performance of the Budget Stabilization Fund as of the period ended June 30th, 2014. Please report that for the 1, 2, and 3 year period ended June 30th, 2014, the investment rate of return, net of expenses, investment expenses, has approximated 1.92 to 1.95%, pretty consistent. It's just a hair under 2%. If you go back to the 5 year period, you see actually rates were higher 5 years ago. It's just a function of the current low interest rate environment today. But all things considered, for a portfolio that has an average credit quality of probably a AA minus, if you blend the Bank of North Dakota CDs with the JP Morgan and Babson kind of credit quality, it's pretty high quality short term, and overall meets our investment goals and perspective of the Budget Stabilization Fund. I think it's important to note that the fund has exceeded its policy benchmark by a considerable margin. So what does that mean? If you try to compare this rate of return versus like an index investment, we're actually beating that by using active management and also benefiting from kind of the duration that's added by the Bank of North Dakota CD program. On page 7, I highlight the investment fees and basis points that are paid by the Budget Stabilization Fund. In the middle of the page, kind of right there, you can see the fiscal year 2013 and fiscal year 2014 investment expenses expressed in basis points, or 1/100%. Between fiscal year 2013 and fiscal year 2014, expenses remained relatively flat. They actually declined from 13 basis points, or 0.13%, to 0.12, a nice low-cost program overall. During that same point in time, we see that actual investment performance net of fees actually increased slightly from about 1.87 to about 1.94%. Again, it's just reflecting kind of the underlying escalating rates in the overall underlying rate environment. At this point in time, I will flip to the next page and discuss the legacy fund, unless we have any further questions on the Budget Stabilization Fund at this point in time.
Are there any other questions on the Budget Stabilization Fund?
You did have one, Jerry.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave, on page 3, when you were talking about income distributions out, what would those all include, that $40 million?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, may I ask if OMB would know actually what the expenditures would normally be? So what would happen from a real perspective is we would be instructed by the Treasurer and Office of Management and Budget to create a distribution, and then we would send out the payment of expenses or any type of distributions, what it is.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Let's just recognize the chairman has arrived and will now be taking over.
Go ahead, Sheila.
I'm going to look to Alan and Sheila to also perhaps answer this, but I'm wondering if we really haven't had any distributions from the Budget Stabilization Fund per se for spending. So my guess is these have been adjustments based on actual expenditures that are passed by the legislature, that more money perhaps went into the fund than the percentage that was supposed to go in.
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that would be the income distributions, that when the fund is at its maximum, okay, that the investment income goes to the general fund, and that's what gets transferred.
So this is the excess over the max.
Right. Yeah, because when the fund is earning its investment income, if it can't go in the fund, it gets transferred to the general fund.
Thank you.
Very good, Mr. Chairman, members of the board and committee. It's appreciate that update, the understanding it's a transfer of the kind of the excess income out of the fund. Very good. I just want to state that at the end of this kind of legacy fund, I wanted to go through the investment policy statements. I actually think it's good to go through the investment policy statements of both the Budget Stabilization Fund and Legacy Fund at the same time, because they're very comparable from a conceptual perspective. But at this point in time, unless there are any further questions, I will move to the Legacy Fund. On page 8, you will see a legacy fund policy timeline that starts in April 2013 when the new strategic asset allocation for the legacy fund was approved. In June of 2013, the SIB approved the transition plan to implement the new policy over a period of 18 months. As of July 2013, the SIB actually approved the asset allocation and use of the existing managers within the insurance trust to kind of implement the policy going forward. The key reasons behind that was in order to kind of have efficiency of execution, aid the overall implementation speed, and keep costs down overall, which I think when you look at the cost going forward, you will see that we've achieved that goal. In August of 2013, REAL initiated the 18-month transition plan, and in January of 2015, in a few months, we expect to be fully implemented with our new asset allocation policy, which is 50% equity, 35% fixed income, and 15% diversified real assets. On the next page 9, I'm going to just highlight a status of the overall legacy fund at this point in time. You will see that as of August 31st, 2014, the actual market value of the investments approximated $2.45 billion. If you look at fiscal year 2015, the most recent 2 months, including July and August, you'll see that we actually received almost $229 million during the first 2 months of the fiscal year, so a little under $115 million a month, and that continues. As of
Dave, how much, and I guess, how much of that is rollover from the SIF fund going into that? Or do you got another?
We do have a slide. That is a perfect.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Perfect lead into the next slide. So in this chart, you can see kind of the rollover from the SIF fund. So you can see in that one page, kind of the orange highlight is kind of 25% from the SIF. Let's see how I could easily do that. It's probably in the neighborhood of 20 to 25%. 20 to 25 million? Okay, very good. Based upon discussion with my deputy CIO, Darren Schultz, is in the neighborhood about $20 to $25 million.
Okay, then Dave, you go back to page 9, and then the 113 million for 14, is that okay? Is that earned income, or is that part of the SIF money too?
That is, Mr. Chairman, members of the board and committee, the 113 million under fiscal year 2014 net increase. That's actually investment income. So that is not transfers of kind of principal from the SIF.
Okay, that's what I wanted to understand.
No, very, very good. So just since we're back on this page, it's worthwhile to highlight. So net increase represents investment income within the legacy fund since inception at approximately about $129 million. And if you were to look at the market value of the investments as of the close of business yesterday or today, it would approximate about $2.68 billion. And that's after reflecting some very significant contributions of about $110 to $112 million in September and October.
Okay.
We kind of already covered this page. Really what this page
is... Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
So Dave, that increase represents not only investment earnings, but appreciation. Is that right?
That is correct. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mr. Hardenmeyer, that increase represents investment income, dividends, capital appreciation. It's kind of anything that would be increasing beyond kind of our acquisition cost of the marketable investment.
Okay. Continue.
Very good. We kind of covered this page already on page 10, which kind of talks about the composition of how the funds are coming in blue from oil extraction, in green from oil production, again 25% from the SIF and kind of the orange color. The small amount in yellow is kind of the SIF transfer from the land board to the legacy, and then the red line going across represents the market value of the combined assets over time. And as of August 31st, 2014, is approximating close to $2.5 billion as indicated on the right-hand column, right-hand axis. On to the next page, I'm going to highlight kind of the legacy fund strategic asset allocation. In the bottom right-hand corner, we have the policy allocation. This is what we target to be at January 31st of 2015 as approved by the State Investment Board and as recommended, I believe, by the Legacy Fund and Budget Stabilization Advisory Board. The targets are 30% for U.S. equity, 20% for international equity. You see in the blue and red bars pieces of the pie on the right bottom corner of the page up on the screen. In the left-hand corner, you'll see the fixed income component will represent about 35%, and then you'll see a 15% allocation to diversified real assets, 10% for diversified real assets, and 5% for core real estate. If you look in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see the current allocation, which is working towards that goal. We're not quite there yet. By January 31st, we will. Currently, we're about 50% equities, about 24% what I would call kind of longer-term fixed income investments. The bar chart up there is the short-term fixed income investments, about 15%, which we're transitioning out of over an 18-month time frame. And the blue and purple pieces of the pie up in the upper left-hand corner represent the core real estate and diversified real assets component, respectively. Just to help drive home what diversified real assets represent at this time, it represents treasury inflation protected securities or global index linked securities, which will provide kind of wage and inflation protection.
Okay. Any questions? Okay, Dave.
Very good. Go ahead.
I do have a question. On the fixed income portion, what portion of that is in U.S. Treasuries?
At this point in time, I will need to refer to another piece of paper that I have here. Bear with me. I believe it's approximately, here I have it. As of August 31st, 2014, the State Street kind of government securities index allocation was about $84 million. That actually understates kind of our overall allocation to treasuries, because treasuries are held by many of our investment managers. If I were to pull together all of them together, it'd be a significantly higher component than that. But we look to treasuries as the ultimate place to hold a conservative security when things are challenged, when things are tough. There's nothing that compares with the U.S. Treasury security for liquidity and value during a challenging period of time, such as the great financial crisis. There's really nothing parallel in our investment portfolio that matches it at this point in time. Having said that, U.S. Treasury securities do not provide a lot of income opportunity during a period of rapid expansion, so we use it as kind of a anchor to maintain conservatism within our overall portfolio from a diversification perspective. Mr. Hartmeyer, does that address your question?
Well, let me just take one step further then. You know, the nature of the maturities of those, do you have any idea what those might be?
The nature of the government securities for the State Street would probably be in the neighborhood of a 5 to 10 year average duration.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And then, Dave, and then do you go into the next page, then it kind of got the breakdown percentage-wise of how you're investing in.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, on page 12 we have the more detailed asset allocation of the various sectors. You'll see on page 12 the large cap domestic equity represents about 22%, small cap U.S. equity represents about 8%, international equity represents a little under 20% at this time. Fixed income, the asset class that we were just referring to, overall represents about 24% of our asset allocation. Diversified real assets equals 5.8%, and real estate is at 5%, consistent with its policy weight as of August 31st, 2014, based upon market values as of that date. The other key component at the very bottom is kind of short-term fixed income. That's the assets that we're transitioning out of, right? A couple years ago, 18 months ago, is at a point in time when we were heavily invested in short-term fixed income. During this 18-month transition plan, we're moving out of short-term fixed income into these more income-generating assets going forward.
And Dave, like going down on some of those, the international equity, give me an example of what that all entails. You know, what are our risks and where are we at with that?
So from an overall kind of portfolio diversification perspective, we mm-hmm. have equities, fixed income, and real assets in order to maintain kind of a proper risk return and exposure. If you were to look over kind of a 10 to 20 year time frame, there's going to be various periods of times when U.S. equities are going to be in favor, or when international equities will be in favor, or fixed income securities such as U.S. Treasuries during the great financial crisis were the best thing to be holding at that point in time. Mm-hmm. During more recent times, with significant real estate appreciation, one of the best returning assets that we've actually had was our real assets and diversified real assets portfolio, just because real assets are performing well during a period of growth, particularly coming off of the great financial crisis, when a lot of real assets that had liquidity issues were really penalized because of that liquidity. So from an overall perspective, international equity plays a very meaningful part of our overall diversified investment portfolio profile. We have about 4 or 5 managers that we use in international equity. They include Cap Guardian, LSV, Dimensional Fund Advisors, and Vanguard are our four main kind of international equity managers who have performed very well overall, generated probably a return of in excess of 20% over the past year, ended June 30th, 2014.
Does that cost a little more then to use those? But we're still, you still got a 20%. We're still looking at 20%.
Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, that's a great point. Clearly, international equities, to invest in international equities costs a bit more in basis points than it does in U.S. equities or in short-term U.S. Treasury securities. However, we're always looking at not only the return but the risk, including the fees associated with it. And when we go through this a little bit later, I'll hopefully be able to show to you that in our overall perspective, we're getting a nice risk return. The amount of dollars that we're spending on investment management fees are being rewarded in a multiple of the excess investment returns that we're getting out of our international equity, U.S. equity, and even our fixed income sectors.
Okay, because I had one of my constituents, and they always, you always get an expert, but they brought that, international kind of trigger to question, and I that's why I was kind of asking, because it does, when you mention international as well, is that, how risky are we and stuff on it, and that's why I just wanted to have kind of an answer to when I talked to them again.
Absolutely. So the key is to maintain, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, is always maintain a very diversified approach. So for the last year, it was great if we would have all invested in U.S. equities. They were the strongest performing sector overall. International equities still performed very well, close to a 20% or overall 20% return. But U.S. equities for the year ended June 30, 2014 was in excess of 24 to 25%. Things rotate. And if you, obviously, over a long period of time, there's times when the international equities will be more in favor than U.S., but we're going to keep a diversified portfolio to always have a nice balanced return profile.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Question on diversified real assets. Since real estate's considered a separate line, what all is included in diversified real assets?
At this point in time, Senator Nelson, members of the board, diversified real assets consists 100% of global inflation-linked index securities. It's a way to say it's a government-issued security that has a inflation protection built into it, so it's very conservative. Over time, going forward, that diversified real asset investment will be redeployed into what I think you would more commonly, what I would more commonly think of as a real asset, something like an infrastructure investment.
I was thinking more like timber, and because back in the dark ages when we were investing teachers' retirement money, that was one of the categories was lumber and the along with the real assets, but they are, the real estate, but there was kind of together, so this definition kind of threw me for what is that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mrs. Senator Nelson, that's a great point. The Teachers Fund for Retirement does have an investment in timber. So does the Public Employees Retirement System. At this point in time, you're right. Diversified real assets, kind of a nondescript term. It says diversified, which hopefully most of your portfolio is in real assets. Going forward, we can add a little bit more better designation to say it represents an infrastructure investment or an inflation-linked securities investment to add greater clarity and understanding. But at this point in time, there are no timber investments in the legacy fund.
Okay. Any other questions, committee?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, in regards to the cash equivalents,
excuse me, do we have a practice of how much cash we'll keep on hand, or do we? As the revenue comes in, do we pretty much invest the cash that we have as it comes in? How are we handling that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kreit, we are, given the nature of the legacy fund, we can keep our cash balances pretty low because it's different than a budget stabilization fund or even an other employee retirement system where you're going to have distributions out on a regular basis. We do our best to keep our cash and cash equivalents balance very low because we don't have any immediate kind of cash funding needs. Having said that, when you are rebalancing there and you're getting income distributions of dividends or interest income, there are just natural noise in which, as of any point in time, you're going to have a small amount of cash kind of inherent in your portfolio, and that's really what you see at this point in time. That 0.1% is just kind of the overall kind of cash position that will be quickly redeployed within days.
Dave, that brings up, you know, and we've talked about this before, but how, you know, how often is this changing, you know, some of these asset classes changing over? How, well, let's go with like the international equities, you know, how often does that roll over, or is it just when you change managers, or does managers, when you usually set one, usually it's, we're looking at a longer term, or how often do you look at that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, we do not have a lot of manager turnover overall. So from that standpoint, that's a pretty minimal amount. However, quite candidly, we're getting significant cash inflows every month to the tune of $110 to $115 million. I think most recently it was about $112. Because of that, we will redeploy that income that we received from, the cash flow off the oil and gas tax revenues that we receive each month will be redeployed. So we'll be investing new dollars into international equities, into U.S. equities, into diversified real assets and fixed income on a monthly basis as we receive the cash collections. We work with the Treasurer's Office to make sure we're aware in advance of it actually coming in, of the approximate size of the dollar, so we can efficiently and quickly deploy those so that we actually have invested assets earning a rate of return.
Any other questions? Go ahead, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But when you're rebalancing every month, the majority should be going into, according to your chart, to your fixed income, not into those other things. I mean, you got to keep the balances the same, and you're a little bit high right now in broad U.S. equities, but you're way down, like by 11% in fixed income. Obviously, you're going to have to move something to get that up to the 35% you want.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Senator Nelson, that is correct. We will redeploy kind of from the new cash flows coming in into fixed income, where we are actually consistently allocated with our timeline from an overall perspective. But you're right, from an end goal perspective, the one of being targeted at 35% fixed income, we need to redeploy into that capital over the course of the next 4 to 5 months. I do think it's important to point out that there's short-term fixed income and there's fixed income. Right? So when you put those kind of two together, you actually do get a pretty sizable piece, but we're in the process, as previously stated, kind of rolling that short-term fixed income into fixed income going forward.
Well, I was looking at your chart here, and it's at 24% versus 35 in green. But that's also the end of August. Can you tell us where we were the end of October, which is now, and several months later?
Very good. I do not have the numbers for the end of October with me right now. What I think it's important to point out, though, is that policy allocation that we see in the bottom right-hand corner, that policy allocation is the target as of January 31st, 2015.
3 months, yeah.
Yes. So it's not as of October 31st or of as of August 31st. So actually, if we were to flip to this page, it kind of allocates out kind of how we're allocating each of the dollars into the various sectors historically over time. So when we get to January 31st, 2015, it's our expectation, our goal, our target, and I'm highly confident we will be very close to it, that we will be at 35% fixed income, 50% equity, and 15% diversified real assets, even though we're not there now, because it just takes time, according to our implementation plan, to put that into place.
Any other questions? And if, you know, reading, I'm jumping ahead here, but when it showed what our returns are, we're way ahead of what we were projecting a year ago on what our returns, we're over 6.6 is what I seen there earlier, and so we're ahead of, and I'm guessing that's because of the equity parts has been growing a lot faster than what we anticipated. But
absolutely, yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, that is a great point. So the fact that you're right, we have been over allocated to equities, but a part of it is a function is equities have performed so well. So when we commit dollars and do our rebalancing plan, you put dollars in based upon kind of a current state. when equities performed as well as they have during the year ended June 30th, 2014, and even in more recent weeks, it causes that allocation to go up, and we benefit from that. So, case in point, on page 15, we actually have the legacy fund performance for the 1, 2, and 2 and 3 quarters ended June 30th, 2014. For the 1 year ended June 30, we actually generated a net investment return of 6.64%. That compares very favorably to our policy benchmark of about 5.39%. And our absolute return target of the legacy fund, if I'm not mistaken, is approximately 6.4%. And that's once we're fully implemented in January 31, 2015, going forward from that point in time. So the fact that we've been able to already hit our absolute return target of 6.4% for the year ended June 30th, 2014 is a function of a couple of different things. One is the robust equity markets that we've benefited from over the past year, and kind of, quite candidly, even our fixed income returns have been strong in addition to our diversified real assets as previously discussed. Yeah, this is a nice page. It's a very nice page to be able to show, you know, excess return versus a policy benchmark in an absolute return of 6.6%, which exceeds our kind of our target of 6.4. So.
Okay. Then we'll touch on a little later, and I don't know if you got that in there, you know, just kind of an update, any headwinds showing up or what, you know, that's one of the things, too, oops, that I think we, you know, just visit about a little bit and stuff on that.
Very good. So maybe the next slide I'll talk about is kind of investment management fees. And then if I'm not mistaken, it sounds, Mr. Chairman, like you would like me to discuss just the general overall markets and kind of capital markets conditions. I'd be happy to provide an update on. The next page is schedule of investment management fees. It shows how much we paid for investment management fees in 2013 and 2014. And if you look, if I get this little light to work, our fees on a basis point percentage doubled from 13 basis points to 27, from 13 to 27. Now, that's a pretty significant jump, but you have to realize we went from being invested in short-term fixed income, which is a very low-cost investment option. It only costs, you know, 10 to 12 basis points to invest in short-term fixed income securities, versus we're in the middle of doing a full implementation program. So the fact that we generated a 6.64% return opposite kind of 27 basis points of fees is actually pretty good. That's a nice risk return, right? So one of the questions the chairman had asked previously is, do we feel like we're being properly compensated for the fees that we're paying? And I would argue that we are. And the reason why is because if you look here for the year ended June 30th, 2014, we paid about 27 basis points or 0.2% in fees, mm-hmm. which not insignificant. $4.8 million. But if we were to slide back to this page, the amount of excess return we got was actually 1.25%. So if we give somebody 27% or 0.27% and we get not only our index return back, but a multiple thereof, 1.25, almost 5 times, that's a nice risk return relationship that quite candidly should not be expected to be easily achieved going forward. That's a really nice scenario. If you can realize a 0.5% to 0.75% of excess return after fees, that's a great. This is a really strong story. And again, it's more a function of the overall equity markets in addition to our manager selection in the past year.
Yeah, I know. It always concerns me when you see in some report or something where some investment banker's buying $300 million shore house in Connecticut or something like that. You kind of think, okay, how much of that did we contribute to?
Right. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to just flip forward here a little bit and see if we have anything else. So we've talked about. So just in summary, overall investment performance has been strong for both the Budget Stabilization Fund and the Legacy Fund. Fees have been well managed. We're getting a good risk return as we see here. The only other thing I want to report out at this point in time, before we get a little capital markets update, is talk about enhanced client level reporting. During the past year, our fiscal and administrative and operations officer, Connor Flanagan, worked with Callan and the rest of our kind of investment team to develop some enhanced reporting. That enhanced reporting involves making sure we're tracking kind of intra-month cash flows. As a result of that, we were able to provide some enhanced reporting. It just shows that we're having actually more enhanced reporting, more clarification, kind of, I'm not going to say better returns, but more accurate returns going forward. The result of that enhanced reporting ended up with a minor restatement of fees of about 3 basis points for the prior year for the budget stabilization fund, and the same for legacy. So it's not a huge deal. It's just something to show that we're always trying to get better reporting, greater clarity, greater transparency. And over the past year, that was one of the key goals that we've been able to achieve. So,
well, and it makes a lot of difference, you know, as when the funds are smaller, but as it gets bigger, these that does start to add up when you know, the percent, one of a 0.03 you start talking a couple $100,000 when you start doing that.
But Mr. Chairman, absolutely. I mean, particularly on the size of the dollars that we're investing, any one basis point is significant, let alone three. So it's all important to make sure that we get it as accurate as possible going forward. From an overall capital markets perspective, just to give you my general views, the most recent kind of indicator that came out today was actually consumer sentiment, and it actually was hit a level that had not been hit previously in the last 7 years. Now that's here in the U.S. In the U.S., we have a pretty strong story going on. I'm not going to say that there aren't any issues or concerns out there in the overall U.S. markets, but listen, the Dow and the S&P 500 actually have recovered nicely over the past few weeks. They're near their all-time highs. If you look at corporate America, if you look at the U.S. consumer from a debt level perspective, even if you look at the banking sector, there's been a significant amount of deleveraging that has taken place over the past 5 years since the great financial crisis. When you step back and look and say, how does the U.S. kind of growth outlook appear to be going forward? In my opinion, this is my opinion, I'm pretty confident that the U.S. has a nice picture going forward. And it's a function of a significantly deleveraged consumer, improving consumer sentiment, that's critical. When consumer sentiment improves as much as it has, it's actually at a 7-year high, and you realize that the consumer represents about 70% of the spending in the U.S., that's an incredible kind of growth impediment going forward. From a global perspective, however, we are more challenged. When you look at what's happening in Europe and kind of, you know, international equities, it's not as rosy as a picture. It's much more challenging. There's fiscal austerity measures that are kind of being mentioned in Europe and other types of kind of global kind of macroeconomic geopolitical risks that can cause headwinds going forward. From an overall perspective, the U.S. is still the largest economy in the world. And the fact that if that is as strong as it is today, and that I think it will be going forward, should help lead the globe into a favorable kind of position going forward. It's not to say that it's a straight line going up, but it is to say that I think over the long term, we have very good growth prospects overall.
Well, it's kind of, yeah, and you tie China into, and that's what kind of probably is the one that, we look at Europe and, they got some issues. China, that's one of them that, you kind of get concerned about when you, because you really don't know what you, when you read stuff, one day it's going down, or their growth is dropping, but then you read another day where they're in the market, and I don't know if that's their just the way their government operates, that they try to spook the market to get into a better position or what, but it gets to be a, yeah, they bought all the gold and silver. But that's one of the things that I guess, and the other question is too, is that you see a lot of companies that buy, they've been buying stock back, and I don't know if that's good or bad, on it, and that's one of the other things, is there kind of a are they trying to artificially, move the market or move their stock that way or what too and stuff on it, and that's why I was just kind of curious about that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, kind of my personal opinion, there's lots of things that people do for tax motivated reasons, and if a company were to give a dividend to an individual, there's actually a tax impact associated with it. However, if they go out and repurchase their shares, they're effectively increasing the value of that corporation, which they quite kindly have a very biased view in wanting to increase the value, but there's no tax ramifications of that. So there are times when, given current tax laws in the U.S., in which you can have a situation where perhaps a corporate CEO or board deems it more palatable to do a stock buyback as opposed to paying a dividend or increasing kind of a share payout in some other way.
Okay.
It could be one reason.
Well, it just looks like, that's what always gets, what we've seen here, last couple of weeks, like you said, this kind of stabilized it now a little bit, but there was reports, on Fox Business, there's business channels that you watch, and seemed like they were doing a lot of talking about companies buying back. There's a lot of cash on the sidelines, and it looked like a lot of companies were just using that money to buy back shares and stuff on it, and that's what you kind of get a little, not so much looking at this, just a general overall, is why are they doing that? But that's probably why what you said.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, it does come into play, kind of the deleveraging that has taken place even within corporate America. They have so much cash, current cash as a percent of their current assets is so significant that they feel compelled to deploy it. If they don't feel confident enough to be able to invest in capital and expenditures, they feel the next best perhaps opportunity is by doing a share buyback or some type of M&A activity. And that's what you see take place in recent years, which has seen at very strong levels.
Any other comments, questions? Go ahead, Dave.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, the other kind of component I wanted to focus on was kind of our investment policy statements, and I wanted to kind of do these both at the same time for both the budget stabilization and legacy fund. So at the end, these investment policy statements are about 4 pages in length, so not too cumbersome, not too lengthy. I do not want to read them to you. I figure everyone could go through it at their leisure. What I do want to make a kind of just a point of emphasis on is that this budget stabilization fund kind of investment policy statement, the last time we really did kind of a hard look at it was back in kind of 2009, where if you look at the legacy fund, that was actually signed,
Last year.
So I am recommending no significant changes whatsoever with regards to the kind of the legacy fund investment policy statement at this time, although if it pleases the board, I would suggest that it's good practice if we were to kind of re-sign these each year. It just shows documentation that we're going through it. The other thing that I would just want to make people aware of, one of the kind of key kind of restrictions in here, it deals with kind of social investing in kind of the economically targeted investing. I just want to make sure everyone understands that our investment policy statements for both the budget stabilization fund and the legacy fund explicitly state that we kind of have to apply the what you would call the prudent investor rule. So that means that we really should not engage in economically targeted investing. And that's a key concept. Economic development is great. Quite candidly, the kind of the Bacon North Dakota CD program is an awesome program. It's performed very well in line with expectations. But if we were to sacrifice kind of our prudent investor rules in order to promote economic development, we would be at odds with our investment policy. So I just wanted to kind of point that out from an overall perspective. The other point I wanted to flip back to is on the budget stabilization fund. If you look at page 2 under standards of investment performance, it has some language in here that's it's a little stale. What I would suggest that I would do is, if it pleases the board and the state investment board, is sit down with Pam Sharp, head up of the OMB, and just refresh the standards of investment performance here in the budget stabilization fund to be more consistent with the legacy fund. I'm not recommending any changes other than just from a language standpoint, and tie into 5-year returns. If you look at the language here, it kind of focuses more on kind of annual standard deviation. And if you were to flip over to the legacy fund, they talk more about 5 years, and that's just a more appropriate way of looking at risk and return measures, is over a longer period of time. So that's something I will, if it pleases the board, I will move forward to work with OMB to kind of develop some, what I could call some refreshments, some technical clarifications and refreshing of the language, not really substantive changes.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things that even the history, we had a nice long debate when we first started the legacy about you know, the 15% and all, you know, of all this, and this here was, you know, the stabilization fund was when it kind of got redone in 2009, because before that it truthfully didn't have any money in it, and when we started this policy, we started at 10% of the general fund appropriations started going into this, and then we rolled it back the next session to 9.5. It was kind of the assumption was to prevent allotments, and that's what kind of the budget stabilization fund was for. So it was a year to year, you know, I mean, it basically, and that's how it got treated. Truthfully, that's been one of the things that's been kind of, you know, you kind of grit your teeth, because on a year-to-year basis, you don't do a lot of investing. You're just basically, it's short of putting it under the mattress, but and you can see by the returns too that it doesn't, you know, it's pretty much a, you know, if you needed it tomorrow type thing. And that's something, you know, as far as this board goes, I you know, personally, I wouldn't have a problem doing that, but I think that what we probably wind up doing, since we're getting so close to the session, I think we'd probably bring it in front of the full legislature and see what their attitude was about, you know, changing that into looking at it a little longer term for some of the funds anyways and stuff on it, because it is supposed to be a stopgap between doing allotments is what it's supposed to be, in a shock absorber from if something hits the economy of the state and that we need to keep running. So that's kind of the purpose of it, and that's why, you know, it doesn't do very well, because it is intended to be something that's readily available and on it, and so that's why it's been basically an annual. You could put a two-year deal in it, but it really probably wouldn't make a lot of difference and stuff on it. So that's kind of why that's like it is right now and stuff on it. And that social investing part too, that becomes a, you know, kind of a political animal too and stuff on it, because I think that when people start understanding how these investment works, you realize that it probably isn't the statements as far as that goes, especially the way the state is doing right now, that we have, you know, we do have monies available to do social investing without doing these types of funds and stuff on it. But there again, we're close enough to the session where we'll probably bring that up. If you want to make some points about that, we can sure bring that up when the session starts. But it's probably, you know, because that gets to be a debate within itself on what we, you know, what the intent is of that. And so far we've been kind of, when we first started the legacy fund, we spent a lot of hours talking about investments within the, you know, investing within the state on some of these funds, you know, and you know, just infrastructure issues and stuff. But at the end of the day, it basically became clear that we got to set money aside for that. You don't do these and for near-term investments anyways, and we got to make priorities with what of the discretionary dollars we do have and stuff. And so that we kind of pushed that aside as far as the social investing, and that's why we kind of did with the policy on the legacy side. What we did is look at it longer term, and if the legislature so desires to go take 15%, then fine, but I wasn't going to worry about trying to figure out if the legislature wanted 15%. If they so desire, then we'll have to figure out what's the least costly way to get 15% of the corpus of the fund. But I figured that was getting too confusing, and it was confusing to everybody, and so I figured that we just lay that out. You know, that's a future legislature's problem. If they want to go spend the money, then they're going to figure out what it's going to cost to do it. So I didn't think it, because you can't sit here and try to guess the future, and it's hard enough just trying to figure out if you're going to get some type of return on it. So that's what's kind of the thought process behind that. And I don't know, committee, if you got any other comments or anything like that, or anything.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead, Senator Klein.
Are you suggesting that we draft some sort of legislation that would, or just leave it?
Well,
because you need it to have a discussion, we're going to need something to have.
That's what I was,
about.
Yeah, we could do that,
we
I guess.
We could have Dave, you know, maybe draft something and we could introduce it if there was a, to have that discussion, that whether or not people have an issue with it saying yearly or a five-year. I don't know that, overall, I don't see that as being an issue, because we understand that this fund has to be liquid, and you're just looking at it in a more of a long-term perspective.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Klein, yes, the only reason why I suggest 5 years is just when you think about investing overall, you can run into challenges if you become too short-sighted in looking at risk and return. You're better off looking over an extended period of time. Of course, we're always looking at over a one-year period of time, but when you want to measure if you're actually hitting your goals, you're better off looking at longer term from a risk and return perspective. That's kind of consistently what we've used with regards to PERS and TFFR and legacy fund. We have more five-year frameworks. Having said that, I understand kind of the point that was made about, you know, it's a short-term fund, you're looking at more annual types of things. It's just from a best practice perspective, I would say looking at a five-year kind of risk and return perspective, while you're also looking at 1 year, but judging whether you're hitting your investment objectives over a longer term is kind of a more generally accepted kind of view on kind of how to determine if you're actually hitting your goals. So,
well committee, what do you think? I mean, is it worth, you know, because we really probably should, you know, because these were kind of drafted within the framework of the legislature itself, you know, and since we're so close here, and it would be kind of a policy change on doing something as far as looking at it, because it would change kind of the focus. It would, like you said, it'd be a year-to-year, you'd look at it yearly, but it would be more of looking at a five, you know, probably minimum five-year type investments and stuff on it, and so I don't know.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess the question I would have asked is that this is the board's responsibility. I still believe that it's within our parameters to sit down and decide what would be best here. We're not changing the way we're going to move forward.
True.
We are only, and to bring this and run this all by a committee, everybody would look and say, huh?
Yeah.
Because I still believe that it doesn't sound to me like we're changing our goals. It just sounds like we are clearing up some language to give us the ability to look at the legacy fund, look at the budget stabilization fund as we do the legacy fund, just in a general sort of speaking.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Klein, that's the way. We're not changing the goals. This is just a performance standard. And quite candidly, we could easily say 1 and 5 year or longer, just to give. My whole concept was to introduce a longer-term time frame rather than just being focused on a one-year perspective. So, and this is language that we could easily just say 1 or 5 years and present it to the advisory board here at the next meeting. And we're not changing any policy asset allocation decisions here. This is just a performance metric.
Go ahead, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems kind of ironic. The fund that's been in existence the longest, you have the shortest period on.
Yeah.
Here you have the legacy fund that's been in existence for less than 2 years, and you're saying, okay, let's go out five, whereas you've got the stabilization fund that's been here for quite a while now, and you're saying one. It seems it's kind of backwards.
Well,
but yeah. You know, so I would be in favor of moving this annual to the five also.
Well, I don't have a problem with it. I you know, because yeah, we aren't changing the policy per se.
But Mr. Chairman, at the end, your name will be on the back side, so you'll have to be comfortable with what we do.
Well, no, I'm comfortable. That's a legacy fund, though, side of it, anyways. We can, if you want to do that,
right.
Go ahead. And, does that really cause, like, the social language in there and stuff on it? Like I said, it probably isn't going to be an issue, as far as what we're looking at overall, but go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, Dave, maybe could you give us a marked up version, whereas you would have inserted new language and just lined out similar to what we look at a bill, so that as we look at it, we can see if you think we've strayed too far from what we believe we were doing initially.
I think that would be what I would, I would move that, that Dave...
Her policy and...
Rewrite the policy in the Budget Stabilization Fund and bring it to the next meeting.
Is there a second, to Representative Crate? I guess we really don't need a, do we need, we don't need a vote on it.
Chairman.
Just a vote, oh, Senator.
I'm a little confused here, because the one that you're talking about changing is the one that's signed off on by Pam Sharp and Rio.
Yeah.
Not by the legislature.
No. Well, see, that was signed before we, this board was in the inception of this board. See, and that was, and that gets to be another long explanation of, because it, when, back in 2009, when we updated this Budget Stabilization Fund, you know, and started actually putting money into it, there, and it, just by default, because we talked to Pam about it when it, like, the next session, and, see, it got passed and nobody did anything, you know, so Rio and Pam signed it because there wasn't anybody else around to sign it, basically, and so that's what, see, they're the ones that drew up, it wasn't this board that drew up that policy, it was between Rio and OMB that drew up this policy.
So then shouldn't this have been done prior?
Well, it should have been done...
During this interim?
It should have, and we, when we started out on this, we were focusing on the legacy, or on the legacy fund and getting that invested and the policies in that, and so the Budget Stabilization Fund policies just kind of got rolled along with what we were doing. We really didn't, truthfully, this is probably about the longest conversation we've had on the Budget Stabilization Fund since this, the inception of this board, because it just was, you know, it wasn't, the idea was to basically to prevent allotments is what the idea was behind this fund, and it just got kind of pushed off to the side of, you know, policies and stuff and things like that, because it was functioning of what the intent is on it. I mean, it hasn't really been needed, so it hasn't really been something that we've been set in front of. But like I said, this is probably about the longest conversation we've had on the Budget Stabilization Fund since this board's been...
So then, should a motion be made that we make the proper changes and it be brought back to us to act on?
Yep, that's what we need to do. It is. So I think that's what, yeah, that was, I think, to Senator Klein and Representative Crate's motion. And so we'll do that and kind of make it kind of close to what the legacy fund is basically trying to accomplish too. So call for, yeah, we just need a voice vote on that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All against, nay. Okay, motion passes. Oh.
No, I'm fine with that. I do have a question, though, for Dave. When you look at the Budget Stabilization Investment Policy, and you look at the policy guidelines, specifically social investing, I wonder what your view is on this fund being the funding agent for the match program. Is there a conflict there in your view?
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hartmark, excuse me. At this point in time, given the current size of the match program within the Budget Stabilization Fund, which includes kind of the J.P. Morgan and Babson fixed income investments as well, it is reasonable for it to be included at this point in time. If you were to look at kind of the liquidity requirements that are actually documented in this, it says you could pull up to 2.5% of the general revenue at a point in time for any biennium. And if the general revenue biennium fund, is that roughly $6 billion or?
Yeah, this last session is like 5.8, something like that, general fund.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, so I'm going to just round up to say $6 billion. And if you say you could pull 2.5% of $6 billion at any kind of biennium point in time, that's roughly about $150 million.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you could have like $150 million pull every couple of years it can work at this point in time to kind of have kind of the risk return of the Bank of North Dakota Match Loan CD program at its current commitment size of $200 million, given the fact that you have the other two investments that are shorter duration and even more liquid, represents two-thirds of the fund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and to Eric's point, would that be something that, as we're looking through that, that we want to make sure that we address it properly, or that the language is in there so that we can continue to do what we've been doing in the past?
Yeah.
We don't want to make this, or if we have to tweak it to make sure we understand that that's what we can do, that's maybe that's more the question. Eric, if you wanted to.
Well, at some point, Dave, we need to talk to them about recent action at SIB. So, you know, perhaps you want to do that. And it affects this program and the Bank of North Dakota, and I will tell you right now that I'm in a very much of a conflict of interest point of view on this, since I sit on this board and I'm also, you know, president of the Bank of North Dakota, which is using this program. But we have recently gone up to SIB and asked for an increase from $200 million to $300 million in match financing. As you can see, we're at about, and I'll just fill in the detail, Dave, and we can talk about it. Today, there's about $100 million outstanding of loans. We have requests either on our desk or in the hopper for another $120. Puts us over the $200 million. Those more than likely won't be funded for another 6 to 9 months. Looking ahead, I approached the SIB board in September and asked for an increase in that allocation from $200 million to $300 million. Seeing that, you know, the deals that are coming to the state are larger, they're more frequent, it's an important program. And I also asked for an increase in the interest rate term from a 5-year to a 10-year fix. And so in the last 2 months, we brought that up, and Dave, I'll let you describe the action that was taken. And I just wanted to get this framed up for you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mr. Hardmeyer, so at the last State Investment Board meeting, which was last Friday morning, I made a recommendation to not actually even promote the increase from $200 million to $300 million to the board. The reason why is because we have to follow the prudent investor rule. And the Bank of North Dakota Match Loan CD program is a great program. It is very high quality. It's AA-plus rated. But they do have the ability to enter into longer duration match CDs, like 5, and actually the request was to go out to 10 years. As I think everyone understands, in a low rate environment in which we're in right now, for us as the lender giving funds to the Bank of North Dakota from a match loan CD perspective, to lock in rates in this low rate environment is not prudent, because you run the risk that rates will escalate in the future, and then we would be trapped in with a very low rate for a moderately long period of time. When we look at our other kind of components of this budget stabilization fund, which is very short-term nature and focus, given its rainy day kind of feature, we try to keep the duration inside of 3 years. Actually, J.P. Morgan and Babson are both inside of 2 years. So we kind of have a conflict of increasing the size of this particular program beyond its current size. When we've sized this overall budget stabilization fund, we set about a third, up to $200 million for Bank of North Dakota CDs, which have a term currently up to 5 years from an interest rate perspective, and the remaining $400 million approximately at very short term, and it matches the risk, liquidity, and return profile. So that's the reason why, quite candidly, myself made that recommendation, and Deputy CIO Darren Schultz confirmed, and we feel it's the right thing to do from a prudent investor perspective. Economic development is great. This is a great program. Historically, since 1989 or whenever it's been in place, interest rates have been coming down, right? It's great to lock in long-term rates as an investor when rates are coming down. It's worked very well. the chance of rates falling further substantially from where we're at now is not near as great as rates going up. So it's a point in time where we wouldn't want to kind of increase our exposure at this particular point in time. It's something I always suggest, 6 months from now, a year from now, a different rate environment, we can reassess it. But at this point in time, in my belief, it's not a prudent thing to do.
Yeah, and committee, and this is where you get in where the politics and the prudent investor gets to be, and that's one of the things that, you know, because it, and that's something that probably is probably something that should be brought in front, because I know there's a lot of talk of other program, you know, and this is, truthfully, this fund is going to get talked about, I'm pretty sure, during the session, and along with the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund too, as far as loans for schools and stuff like that. It one of the things, and it's been brought up in past sessions, a fund that isn't working is a useless fund, and it does get to be, you know, at some point, where do you start to, you know, because if we do the 9.5 at the end of this next in June of next year, and make a payment into this fund again, you're talking close to $1 billion, $900 million that could be sitting in this fund. And you do have to, you know, and that's something that we do have to look at. And this committee, it's been one of my things that with this has been frustrating. The fund isn't, it's to preserve the principal is probably the main goal on it, you know, but it becomes when you cap, and you know, everybody knows as well as I do, you start capitalizing time, it's really not, you could probably just as well spend the money and try to make it up later on, because you're losing on the long run of it. But go ahead,
Senator. Mr. Chairman, and just for Dave's benefit, that coming into maybe his first session in North Dakota, you know, we look to the bank to do a lot of projects. Economic development is a big deal, and there's going to be I can imagine a lot more tugs on the bank's funding and finances and ability to create additional investment. So I'm just kind of like alerting you that I believe that, in listening to what I've heard today, and maybe Eric will give us more information, but that there will be additional attempts to use that money as a match, as of some sort of ability to invest in North Dakota. Yeah, J.P. Morgan's nice, but seeing Landscaping with a new combine is even looks nicer, I suppose. But you know what I'm saying is things that we can see in North Dakota, where people see that we've, you know, because there is still a mistrust of the big folks out wherever. So I just kind of given you what I believe we may see, and as legislators, we see a lot of these things. I've been around a little while now. We've seen a lot of bills and a lot of efforts to use Bank of North Dakota money. So I'm just kind of giving you a heads up on that.
Well, what it comes down to is the bank becomes, it, you know, with the state isn't going to get directly involved in a lot of these, but that is a way for the state to get directly involved in it. And that's what, you know, that's kind of why if there is some, you know, we don't necessarily always follow the prudent investor rule, you know, and stuff. We're hoping that we get some type of return on what we do invest, but the length of time becomes an issue, you know, on it. And that's one thing that this fund, that's why I've kind of gritted my teeth too, would be because it is such a short term, you know, it doesn't, you know, the intent of it, like I said, is a rainy day. But when you start looking at how much would you actually, if you did have some shortfalls in the economy, how far would it have to fall before you actually started to use a good chunk of this fund? And truthfully, you'd really have to have some major, I mean, there'd be a lot of other problems going on before you started tapping more than $100 to $200 million of this fund in any one given biennium on it. And that's been one of the, you know, question marks about how we've, you know, what we've struggled with too on it. And truthfully, I wouldn't have a problem moving up with it, you know, I mean, as far as what I know as where we sit today, I mean, unless oil drops down to $30 a barrel or something, then that could tune everybody up. But like I said, there'd be bigger problems if that happens. But, you know, I don't want to, but that's just my feeling too on it. Go ahead, Senator Klein.
So, Mr. Chairman, and maybe Eric, now you could add, you know, the discussion must, we certainly, I believe that the money will be there, that the investments will be prudent. And I understand where, what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the discussion then as you got to the end?
Well, the discussion was actually to come here. And, you know, as Dave said, it was his recommendation along with Darren that they hold at $200 million, wait till rates move at some point. How much, you know, we talked about 50, 75 basis points. And, you know, as I said, I'm very conflicted in all this, so I'm just going to lay that out. But for the Bank of North Dakota, the issue is trying to determine and to market a program where you don't know when additional funds will be made available, if ever. And so are we locked at 200 indefinitely? Or is there the potential to get above and beyond? And so if we're out here marketing state economic development programs and you have to go and say we are committed at our $200 million, we have nothing left to provide until rates move, and then the next question becomes how far do rates have to move? And so it's chasing this elusive number that is frustrating. And when I look at, you know, if I could just, when I look at, you know, the fund policy return levels of 61 basis points, 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 5 years, and I look at what the Bank of North Dakota's contribution to that is, and Dave, I don't know if you have our overall contribution to that 194, but I would guess it's much greater than that, probably in the neighborhood of 3 to 4.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hardman,
yeah,
I don't want to speak without knowing the exact returns.
Yeah.
It is clearly north of 2%. It's probably, it could be historically as high as 3%. Those are just going off the top of my head, which I can go back and confirm. The point that I think it is important to realize is that the historical rates that we're earning today were created during a point in time in which interest rates were higher.
Yep.
So, you don't think I'm beating a dead horse here, but end of the day, the rates at which we would extend loans out today, if we were to do a five-year term, would not meet the 1.94. And that's the concern that I have is from a prudent investor perspective.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's been great historically, an outstanding program. I think economic development's wonderful, but if you have to apply to a prudent investor rule today where we're sitting in a rate environment, it doesn't quite meet that return expectation going forward, even though it's done a great job in the past, and it's all function of rate environment.
No.
What is the benchmark then?
The benchmark probably should be the Barclays Gov Credit 1 to 3 year index going forward. That's actually a blended rate between T-bills of about 30-day T-bills, which is probably too low, and Barclays Gov Credit to the tune of about 80%. So that benchmark actually would probably push up going forward, given what we know today.
What would you say? It'd be at what?
I would. So going forward, I would probably say we would adjust that fund policy benchmark. So right here, we're talking about total budget fund policy. Per policy, it's at 0.61% right now. That was for the period ended June 30th, 2014.
Yep.
Going forward, given the rate environment where we're at now, and we're taking a harder look, we would probably increase that to a level above 1% at this point in time, going forward, above 1%.
Well, what if we did do that as a, you know, like this, you know, set something that, you know, make more certain, you know, I mean, it's artificial, you know, I mean, we're just going on kind of what, but what if, or would it kind of put you in, or what you're dealing with into a bind, or even if we did raise it, say we went 2 basis, you know, went up to like a 0.8, would that still be something that would be, where it'd reflect some concerns of what the...
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just for additional information, the way this program is priced to the borrower at this point is the borrower gets the U.S. Treasury rate plus a quarter. This fund gets the U.S. Treasury rate, and you can go anywhere from a 1-year fix to a 5-year fix. That's as far as you can go, and then it rolls either annually or every 5 years. So the 5-year, when you and I talked last week, was 142, 143, somewhere in there. So that's why I was curious about what is the benchmark. And you know, while I'm laying it all on the table, I mean, the issue that I had is that I couldn't quite understand what, you know, where rates are going. Nobody does. And this rate over the course of the last, you know, 25, 30 years, we've had, you know, high rates and low rates. And it's unfortunate today that it's low rate. It's good for the borrowers, bad for the lenders. But it's a point in time. It's a moment in time. When I came to Dave in September, the 5-year was at 177. Well, it backed up 30 basis points due to some, you know, bad news in the market and went down to 142. I don't know what it is today, but, you know, rates move up and down frequently. And so that's the issue for us is, you know, now it seems like we're just pointing to a point in time and saying rates aren't going any lower. So why would we want to do that? Well, this program needs to be marketed throughout the course of time. And in a year, 2 years, 3 years, you're going to get different rates. But it's, and I, you know, don't mean that you cut us off because we asked for more money run the program. So, and that was the
politics of it, you know, and that's the problem, you know, the history. When I first got involved in this, the bank is, we've tried to keep the bank out of the politics of it as much as possible and stuff on it, but it does get to be, it does get to be where policies and common sense sometimes run head on to each other. And I'm not saying this isn't common sense, but it at some point it does become a policy issue whether you're going to capitalize on the highest market or you're going to capitalize on something that, and that is a concern, I think, of a lot of things, and it's a concern of mine too. And we're sticking, we've got our eggs in a one bigger basket now, and it concerns me because I live out in the western part of the state, and I've seen these oil, anytime you're basing your economy on commodities, becomes very, I get a little nervous about it because you can make a lot of money, but you can lose a lot of money. And the thing is that we need to get more stability in the industry, you know, one way or the other. And I don't know what Eric's working on or what you got going, but the thing is usually it is something that either broadens out the base of a commodity or else it's something that doesn't even, it's close, but it isn't. And that's where we got to start figuring out what we want to do with it. Go ahead, Carolyn. Sorry, Senator Nelson.
No, that's all right. Just a question. I never like putting anything specific with like 0.8 in. When we do our housing and that type of thing, it's flexible. It deals with what the GSA is. Is there some sort of a formula you can come up with that combines the Treasury with the Barclay and fluctuates with time that might be something that would move you when the rates went up, you know, would allow for more money. When the rates went down, you'd say, hey, we don't have it. But, you know, put in something other than a fixed rate into whatever you're using.
Well, I think one of the problems is, though, with what Eric's talking about is a known factor is what, you know, if you're going to go sell this, you're trying to sell a known commodity. And I think that's what, you know, at that time, you know, if you say it's going to be this, then, and you say 5 years or something, you need to know it's going to be 5 years before that.
Well, in the marketing, though, you can say something if the financial, you know, situation is such that it'll bear it. I run an organization that gives scholarships, and we have a thing on the bottom that says if funds exist, because Our scholarships are based on what kind of income we get. We can't go into the endowments, so we have to go on income. If we don't have the amount we advertise, it's right out there that, hey, you might not get $600 or $1,000. You may only get $550 or whatever. But they know ahead of time that go ahead and apply. There's a good chance you might get this, but it might be a little bit less.
Go ahead. Mr. Chairman, I guess just thinking this through, two things. First of all, is this our responsibility as a committee to determine whether or not $100 million would go to the bank? I'm not sure.
It is.
When we first
started talking about this budget stabilization, it's to maximize out investments within the budget stabilization form and within the budget stabilization fund. It's to kind of, but yeah, we might be. This $200 million though was a policy within the OMB though too, isn't it? I mean, because see, the budget stabilization, when this first, it was pretty much between OMB and the SIB, is kind of where the policies started from. And so I'm.
So, Mr. Chairman, did the $200 million start since you've been organized as a committee? Okay, so that was
ahead. That's been ahead. You've been doing that for years before we've had this committee established. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I could just give a little background. Yes, this program, as I said, been around since 89, started at $40 million, worked its way up to $200 million. If you look at the policy guidelines on page 2, you got short fixed income and B and C Ds with a minimum of 90% of the allocation. So to answer your question, you know, Senator Klein, I guess it would be part of the purview of this committee to look at that. As part of a, you know, allocation. And I will make one other point in that, to Senator Nelson's point, we have changed over the years how we've marketed this program. When it first was created, we could go anywhere on the yield curve from 1 year to 15 year. The borrower could pick anywhere from 1 year to 15 year how long they wanted to fix their rate. Well, as we've looked at this with SIB and with some of Dave's predecessors, we backed that down. So the longest you can go out now is 5 years. So over time we have addressed, you know, some of those issues that would give somebody heartburn with extended duration and long-term fixed rates.
But see, you can roll it. You do a 5 year fix, but do you have options to roll it into another 5 years? You know, as far as, I mean, you got a 5 year, but it's a 5 year roll as you.
Yeah. Go. But it is amortizing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So equal annual principal payments come, but yes, you would have the opportunity to
see,
roll
in 10 years. You could drop those amortization payments down somewhat then. Probably.
Well, typically, though, Mr. Chairman, what they would do is they would still keep the term at
5 years and
15-year amortization.
Okay, I see.
And then at the end of 10 years, you'd get a 5-year reset.
Yep.
Well, go ahead. Mr. Chairman, with $100 million, it would not, I mean, it's not like out to shoot in the first couple of months. I mean, this is something that would take some time to work through as, I mean, we're talking time here, is what I'm hearing. You know, I heard at the budget section, Moody's is suggesting interest rates are going to be 5% by the end of the next biennium, which we all kind of shook our heads, but unless you're a senior citizen like myself, who thought that was a great idea.
Yeah.
But so what my question is, doesn't that provide some sort of comfort to the fund, knowing that we will be paying that, you know, you wouldn't be pulling it all out immediately, or can you? Is that how this works?
Well, I thought so.
Okay.
Exactly. I thought it would give some comfort in that we're not pulling it all out. It wouldn't be pulled out probably in any meaningful way for 6 to 9 months to begin with, but that just locks us into the deals that we know today. And there's, as you've talked about, there's more coming, hopefully. Now, we are turning back about $10 million a year in terms of payments that revolves back and allows us to re-lend. So, yeah, this will be spread out over a period of time.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and the track record has been, I don't know what year we quit stealing $60 million out of the bank's income.
2009.
Well, what it's, well, okay, we borrowed it or we're using it in the budget because we had to. But right. With the ability to have an additional money to use in your, in the course of business, you have improved the bottom line of the bank substantially. So what we're asking here is, are we going to be able to improve the bottom line of the Budget Stabilization Fund? Or just at least have it continue about where it's going now? We're not looking at major, this isn't the 6% return, this right. is just a treasury plus a quarter. I guess I'm sort of comfortable with providing additional dollars, but maybe this has to be done. I can see this could cause conflict in the legislature if we said, well, we're going to give the bank $100 million from the advisory board.
Well,
you're depositing money at the bank, which you get a return on.
And that's basically what we're doing right now.
Right.
You know, on it. It's just that it's what it is it's tying. We're going instead of a yearly, if the legislature came and asked for $587 million, we wouldn't have $587 million that we could lay our hands on. We could, but it'd come out of probably the bank's bottom line.
We'd make it available.
Is what would happen right. with it. And see, this is where politics and policy and everything kind of, and business
yeah.
all don't, you know, you're going to, and truthfully, the whole idea behind the bank, though, is to be, and that's, I guess, one of the things is to be responsive to what North Dakota needs is what, you know, I mean, that's pretty much the gist of it. And, you know, we put trust in the president, and I think that becomes a, you know, it does become what good, bad, or otherwise, that's, I guess, a risk we'll take, I guess, like I said, it's not that we're, you know, in the scheme of things, $100 million probably isn't going to save the state, and it isn't going to break it either, you know, and stuff on it, but it does, with what's going on in the state now, I think that's one of the things that we've kind of been priding ourselves on, is to respond to what is needed, and if we got the ability to do it, I think it behooves us to do that. And like I said, we'll have to deal with the politics. If it does go south, then we'll have to deal with that at that point in time. But that's a lot of this. That's what kind of concerns you all across this stuff when we get into this, because you see the markets go south on you, and don't worry, you'll have people on the street watching that too and stuff on it, and that gets to be, you know, but I think that if, you know, I think if there's a sound incoming from the bank, I think that it would be, as far as I'm concerned, I think we should.
Mr. Chairman, are you looking for a motion here?
I'd like to see one
somewhere.
Yeah,
some discussion.
Yeah,
I wonder. Ryan, did you have your hand up?
Oh, I'm sorry, Ryan. I didn't.
Before I get,
and I'll just put in my two cents too, as being involved in a lot of the economic development projects, along with the Bank of North Dakota. I've been in a number of meetings, Mr. Chairman, where we do start talking about coming up with limitations on the match program. It has a high standard for the borrower. Is it still A rating? Some sort of A rating?
Investment grade
yeah. bond rating. And having that loan opportunity balance go up with the amount of activity that we see and the ability to diversify the economy with that loan program, again, high standard, good ratings, and being involved in a number of the meetings from the tax perspective, but hearing the issues with the limitations on the fund from an economic development standpoint hat that I do end up wearing, from the tax perspective, I do think that looking at increasing that loan amount is something worth looking at. That's just from my economic development perspective as well.
Go ahead.
I've been looking, on page 5 here, on the budget stabilization, the 17.9% of the 105 million, that's in, is that some of the money that's being used for this program now?
Yes.
Okay, and that's, the 105 is what's outstanding right now?
Yes.
So if we would go with a percentage of the budget stabilization fund, now you've got 17.9%. If we would go to a 30% allocation of the budget stabilization fund, I haven't penciled it out, but would that be a figure that would be something that would be workable for that program?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, right, so as we recall and as Dave has pointed out, the commitment is $200 million today. And as I said, we have deals in the works that would take up all of that. It would work, and again, I've got to point out that I'm terribly conflicted, you know, in this issue, and I will have to, you know, obviously recuse myself from the vote or anything. But yeah, it would help.
Well, go ahead, Dave.
I just want to make, so what, if you were to increase it from 200 to 300 million, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, you'd be increasing the size of the Bank of North Dakota CD program to greater than 50% of the current outstanding. So when I sit back and I look at, okay, is it a rainy day fund and how liquid and how short term it is and what type of interest rate risk inherent is it, you are significantly changing the liquidity and the risk return profile in today's environment because it's so low. End of the day, the investment policy statement contains a prudent investor rule. Yep. And it's my opinion that that's kind of at odds. However, if the legislature or the governing body makes a decision to say you do not apply the prudent investor rule for whatever reason, and that's permitted, then it's an investment policy statement that we're instructed to follow as the Retirement Investment Office.
Well, I'm assuming, Dave, that it had come, if that did happen, it had come out of the short-term fixed is where that would get pulled from, then. Am I assuming that?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. But that is a...
But, okay, so what I'm trying to figure out then, okay, if we... Okay, out of the 200 committed, then, so what... We basically got 105 committed today is funded. What... Funded. Okay. So that basically we'd be pulling about 195 out of the 475 would be here.
Yep.
Yeah, you'd be right. It'd be right around 50%.
So the average duration of the short-term fixed income in that 475 is less than 2 years. It's probably 1.8, 1.9 years. The average duration of Bank of North Dakota CDs, Mr. Hardmeyer, you may know this better than myself even, it's probably closer to 3.5 to 4 years. So you are extending duration. That's a risk, with particularly within a rainy day fund.
Well, and that's been one of the, you know, see, this is where I'm getting conflicted, because we've had a lot of committee that you haven't been part of within the appropriations process that we've been, you know, that's, and it's been brought up a number of times, a fund that isn't being used as becomes a useless fund. And even 300 million, truthfully, when we kind of redid this back in 2009, like I said, it didn't have much money in it, and it started accumulating quite a bit after we've kind of changed the rules on it. And truthfully, we were thinking that, man, if you could get 150, 200 million in this fund, you know, as a rainy day type fund, you were doing, you know, you were kind of avoiding the allocation or the allotment process. We've got the budget stabilization or the foundation aid stabilization fund too, that's approaching $1 billion too. And see, that's one of the things too, that this is all coming, a little history is coming back from the mid late 80s, where there was a couple sessions where we wound up cutting the second year of K-12 funding, and so that was where a lot of this genesis came from on these funds and stuff on it. you know, it does, one of the thing, and like I said, it does get to be, you know, the mentality of trying to keep the state, you know, looking at that we're progressive in our attitude of attracting business and doing business in the state of North Dakota. It does get to be, if there is some avenues that look like, you know, it becomes prudent to do this, even though, you know, we might be lengthening out the time frame on this, that's part of the policy part that becomes where, like I said, that the business and politics and policy don't always mesh up the right way. And I guess it's like the committee, like I said, I truthfully, coming from the bank, they've got a pretty good track record of what we've been, you know, as far as, I think our main goal, and I think it's preserving the principle is probably our main goal on this budget stabilization fund. As you can see, we haven't been terribly worried about returns on it. If we were, we'd have probably done some different things with it to start with. But it's been more of that as it goes on that we're using it, and if we need it, that it's something that's there on it. And it, I guess, committee, I'm only one vote here on this deal, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and I'm still not exactly sure that if we went to the legislative session and someone suggested that we could use some money for the match fund, as we do a lot of Bank of North Dakota bills that come through the IBL committee, that we wouldn't find a way to do that. But you know, and I don't know if it's 50, if 100 million is the target, or is it more prudent at 50 million? But you know, I certainly think the you know, I'm just still looking for that number to be. I like to pass things in the first vote, but I'm always up for discussion.
Well, again, in my conflicted role, I'll tell you where I negotiated or settled back with Dave was to say, okay, if it can't be 100 million, could it be 50? You know, the deals that we're looking at are larger, and you know, with another 50, we might be able to do another deal or two. They're coming with larger dollar amounts than we've ever seen before.
Well, our next meeting or during the session or something.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move $50 million into the match fund, whatever the proper language would be.
Second.
Second by Representative Crate. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I do have a question about, first of all, would I be eligible to vote in Pam's absence? And not wanting to put words into Pam's mouth, I do think she would defer and lean towards the advice of Mr. Hunter in his current recommendation that we stay in the $200 million mark. So first of all, I guess we need to know if I can vote and if for Pam, and I wanted to explain what my vote would be. If I can,
I think
sounds like it's a no vote either way.
Yeah, I think it's designee is what it says in there, if I remember right, because we've had I think that's what it says. So yeah, you would be eligible to vote on that. And you know, truthfully, I think that there again the. That's what, you know, this is something that, you know, I think at the time, if to move forward with this, I'd feel, you know, probably a little more comfortable doing the 50 versus 100. If we're going to go farther into this, we probably should have the legislature look at it as a little broader aspect of what, you know, what we want to do with this fund, because I know there's discussion going on of what the role is of this fund, and well, all these funds actually, the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund also is becoming a conversation topic. But I right now I do think though that we're, this fund is going to keep growing here in the interim, and if it's something that we need to roll back or something, we'll have to figure that out during the session. But I think that to keep what Mr. Hardmeyer's brought up, and I think that we should take a vote on it and see where we're at with it. Go ahead.
I don't know if I could just ask some question maybe of Mr. Hunter. You had said earlier that by doing this would be in conflict with the investment policy statement. So is there a change that needs to be made in the investment policy statement as part of this motion as well?
I think what I would need to do is consult with legal counsel in order to make sure that we don't have a conflict with the prudent investor rule. And that's, I could do that in a timely manner.
Okay. Well,
And Mr. Chairman, and I'm good with that, and we've had the discussion long before I realized we could make a motion here, that I just thought we were having a discussion about the match fund. Because one way or another, I believe that the legislature is going to address providing additional dollars to help investments come to North Dakota. And whether we do it here or we do it at the legislature, we should do it soon because it is getting dark, and Carolyn has a long way to drive before dark to get back to Fargo. You were late anyway, so it didn't matter.
It's all your fault.
I gain an hour. I gain an
you
hour
gain
going.
You gain an hour. I basically lose one.
Call for the question.
Question. Go ahead. But the what it is that we add another $50 million to the match fund.
Whatever Alan said on the end.
Yeah, with a caveat that if we have to change the policy suspend the policy or something.
We'll be in contact with him, but then the motion would be to recommend to the State Investment Board, because the State Investment Board makes the final decision, but your recommendation to them would be to make this change.
Yep. Representative Chairman Kreit, or excuse me, Chairman Kupnick?
Yes.
Kreit?
Yes.
Senators Vice Chair Klein?
Aye.
Nelson?
No.
Mr. Hardmeyer?
Abstain.
Mr. Rauschenberger?
Aye.
And Ms. Peterson?
No.
It's two votes.
The motion carries.
Well, this isn't the last we're going to hear. And like I said, if there's something where, but we've got these funds available, and it does become something that sometimes but we'll see what happens with it, and we'll go from there. We will.
So thank you very much.
Committee, yeah, we're getting, we got a bill draft in front of us.
Possible
bill draft, okay.
I had legislative council make a copy of that for the committee.
Mm-hmm.
Came out of the government finance committee, and I thought it would be prudent for us to have it in hand as we go into the session, and for the committee members to take a look at it. And anybody got any questions? I'm sure Ellen can explain it.
Yeah. Ellen, do you want to just walk through it for a little bit?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. This bill draft was recommended to legislative management by the government finance committee. Basically, the first section clarifies some of the definitions relating to the legacy fund, because in the Constitution makes reference to some terms that aren't defined. One is, what is at the end of the biennium? So this clarifies that it's after the cancellation of unexpended appropriations, which is basically 30 days after the end of the biennium. Earnings, it defines what earnings are, and this is consistent with the bill that was passed last session, that it is in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, excluding any unrealized gains or losses. And then what is principal? It's the 30% of the revenue that's deposited from oil tax collections, and then it's any transfers by the Legislative Assembly into the fund, and that's consistent with the Constitution. However, the Constitution was silent on the earnings of the fund prior to July 1 of 2017. If those are considered earnings forever, or if they become principal of the fund at that point, So this clarifies that those earnings of the fund prior to July 1, 2017 are part of principal.
Yeah, that's, yeah.
And then the fourth one, what is total revenue from oil and gas tax production and extraction? And that's the total, but it excludes the amounts that are allocated back to the three affiliated tribes. And that's how the tax department has been administering up to this point anyway. Then on the second page, the legacy fund expenditure limit determination. Again, it indicates that the legislature can spend 15% of the principal after July 1 of 2017. So there needed to be a mechanism as to how we're going to determine what is that 15%. So this directs the director of OMB to determine by December 1st of each even-numbered year what that amount is. That way the legislature would have the principal amount that would be available for expenditure during the session. And they would also include that as part of the budget information that they provide during the organizational session. And then finally in section three, once at the end of the 2017-2019 biennium, the earnings of the fund will be transferred to the general fund at the end of the biennium. So this indicates that it's the intent of the, the section does provide that once that transfer is made to the general fund, the state treasurer will turn around and send the earnings directly back to the legacy fund to become part of principal. I guess the thought of the committee was that, you know, initially we don't have any urgent need to spend those monies right now, so the thought was that that should become part of principal. And then there's a section of legislative intent at the end that would continue until either one of two things occurs. If oil and gas tax collections decrease by at least 25% from the previous biennium, or if the earnings of a legacy fund would exceed 33% of total oil and gas tax collections for that same biennium. And again, that's just intent. The statute would still need to be changed, but the idea was that the funds get set aside until actually oil production decreases or the earnings become so great or to a level that funds should be spent after that point. So, and the repeal is just, that was the provision that was passed last session relating to the earnings. It's now included in section one of the bill, so it moved where that definition is in the century code. So with that, I can answer any questions if there are any.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask
a question? Go ahead.
Alan, the last sentence in section two, which says the available funds may not be included in draft appropriation acts, I assume that means that the governor then would be prohibited from spending any of that 15% in his recommendation, that's the purpose of that sentence.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, that is the intent of that it wouldn't be included in the governor's recommendation.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, is there any questions? Other Senator
Did this
Nelson?
Come out of committee unanimous vote, or do you remember?
There might have been a couple negative votes. I'm not sure, though. We could probably check it out real quick.
I'm still trying to figure out how that last section works. I would have liked to have seen. And you're just going to keep adding and adding and adding to the fund. You don't talk about taking anything out of the fund. You keep adding to it. But somewhere along the line, somebody's going to come and say, hey, we want to use some of this.
Well, and that gets to be a bigger question. And I it was kind of interesting because I was reading an article the other day where the Norwegian fund, it's huge. It's pushing just about, 800 and some billion dollars. They don't have a statement in there of how they're going to spend it. They're accumulating it. At some point, yeah, you're going to have to figure it out. I seen a poll the other day about North Dakotans, they'd like to get some of the money back, and that, talking to the Alaskan fund managers, that's a slippery slope when you start down that, and you look at Wyoming's taking a portion of theirs, goes into funding education. Unless we get a better handle on our higher education system, as far as the functioning of it, I'd have a hard time just throwing more money at that, but that's my personal opinion. Texas has two funds, actually, that one's in education, the other one's kind of a general legacy fund, but they have two that are about, equal up to about $62 billion on it. But Alan, go ahead, yeah.
The vote was 12 to 2.
12 to 2, so, and then...
It's already managed the legislative management, so we really don't have to act on it.
No, we're just, this is just information, I think, is, yeah. Yeah, I heard rumblings that they were going to do something like this, and that's going to be, like I said, this is a bigger picture. This is going to be a debate starting this session on where, you know, if anything, and it's, this is going to be a, I got a feeling we're going to be talking about this for a few years on where we're going to go with this. But let's start, I guess, that's it. So, is there any other thing for the good of the order? I'll entertain a motion then to adjourn. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. Yeah, I was doing about...
Luckily, there's no construction, so I set the office late, it's coming. Outside of that, I can do my...